Welcome to Head Start, the podcast for race directors and the business of putting on races. When you want to know what's happening and trending in the endurance events industry by the numbers, where do you turn to? Well, for me and many people I know, the definitive source of event data for the industry is, and has been for some time, GiveSignup Run Signup's annual Race Trends Report. The report leverages GiveSignup Run Signup's extensive registration data from almost 60,000 events to point to trends in event participation, event pricing, participant demographics, marketing effectiveness, technology adoption, and a myriad other things. The most recent edition of the report was out just last week, and the data does seem to point to a strong but partial recovery from 2020, with some numbers starting to converge to 2019 pre-pandemic levels. With me today to discuss all the numbers, the trends, and their implications for individual events and the industry as a whole, I'm delighted to have GiveSignup Run Signup's own Johanna Good. Johanna is the driving force behind many great things coming out of GiveSignup Run Signup, including the ever-improving annual Race Trends Report, so she's just the person to walk us through the insights and recommendations coming out of the 2021 numbers. Unfortunately, there's just too much data in the report to be able to cover fully in today's episode, but you can, and I would strongly encourage you to, download the full 2021 Race Trends Report for free at runsignup.com/trends. That's runsignup.com/trends for your free copy of the 2021 Race Trends Report. Okay, I can't wait to get into the numbers. So, without further ado, let's jump into the episode. Johanna, welcome back to the podcast.
Thanks, Panos. It's great to talk to you again.
Last time we spoke, I think we were discussing the Winter Symposium, which unfortunately, very sadly, you guys decided to cancel. Would have been a great opportunity to catch up with you guys and the rest of the Race Director community. Wise decision, though. How did you arrive at that?
I think we were just watching, like all race directors have been doing, kind of the conditions around the country. We knew we were putting on an indoor event with people flying from all over the place, including our own team having to fly there from all over the country, and decided the timing was about as bad as it could be. I think had it been a little bit earlier, a little bit later, we might have just missed the biggest wave, but we didn't want to create more problems in hospitals and such. So made the decision to call it this time.
I think it was a responsible thing to do. Must have been pretty stressful, though, over Christmas and stuff, because I saw the announcement come out on the 29th, and it couldn't have been easy taking that decision. So it must have been pretty stressful holiday season for you.
Well, we were kind of trying to move forward as though we were going to do it just to make sure we were ready to go. But yeah, we knew at that point that it was probably best to let people know and let them, you know, have some time to cancel flights and stuff.
Well, it's a shame, but then, you know, it's a biannual thing, so hopefully we'll see you guys in your summer symposium proper. I don't expect that's going to be facing any issues. Hopefully, fingers crossed, right?
We hope so. We're walking a little bit slow to make sure we don't want to have to cancel another one. So we're kind of taking our time making a final decision, but we are hoping to see everyone soon.
And that's June or July?
July.
In Philly, right?
Correct, yeah.
Okay, awesome. And then after that, of course, you know, having canceled the winter symposium, you also have the burden of compiling the Race Trends Report that we're going to be talking about today, right?
Yeah, so this is an annual report that we put together. And I think we started 7 years ago pulling data from our system to kind of create a picture of how we think the industry is doing.
Yes, and I have to say, I've been following the report, probably not for the whole 7 years, but for the past 3 or 4 years. And it has been getting better and better. It was already a very, very valuable report. It just has data that you simply cannot find anywhere else. Like whenever someone either in the group or offline asks me, you know, where can we find stuff on, you know, like demographics, participants, prices of events, it is the only reliable data store I can turn to.
Yeah, I think that was really the impetus behind starting it, is there isn't a single aggregator for data within the industry because there's so many different registration platforms. There's just a lot of different places that hold data. And because of that, it was often really hard to make a real determination of what's going on. And we are not then going to be a perfect determination because we don't represent every event out there. But we've grown a lot. I think we have our market share estimated around 30 to 40% of US events, which is a pretty good number to draw some conclusions from. There are certain places where we can say, you know, this number might be slightly impacted by a tool that we have that other events, you know, other platforms don't have, or by the type of events that pick us. But in general, we have enough volume to really, you know, draw some good conclusions.
Right. Okay. I think that's important. And I think when last we did with you and Bob, we had like a mini race trends thing at the end of last year. I think this is a very important point to make, that basically the data we're looking at here is run signup data, but we're saying that on account of the fact that, you know, run signup now is like 40% of the market or something, it's as good as being market data, with the exception of some subtle points here and there that we may touch on, where because it is run signup data, it may have some slight biases here and there, right? But overall, it is, I think it's as good, it's as close as we can get to like a market-wide data report. So looking at the 2021 report, which we're also going to link to in the show notes, and it's widely available, free to download, we should say, from runsignup.com/trends. You can find the report downloaded, pages and pages of great numbers and statistics on the industry. So looking at 2021, how was the picture sort of like high level overall for registrations? Was 2021 more like a 2020 or a 2019? And what does this, you know, what does the data also tell us about potentially how 2022 may look like?
Yeah, I think we saw 2021 as kind of split in the middle between a normal 2019 year and what was 2020. There was about 21.6% growth in events from 2020 to 2021. And the way we calculate that is by looking only at events that were on our platform both of those years, because we want to be able to compare, did actual races grow, not did our platform grow? So we did definitely see a lot of recovery compared to 2020. At the same time, we also, normally we just look at, you know, 1 year to the next for that type of information. This year, we actually rolled back and did a slightly different report. I won't go into the nitty-gritty of why the numbers are slightly different. But looking at 2019 events and events that were on our platform in 2019 and 2021, and from those, we actually did see about a 23% decline from 2019 to 2021. So races definitely still saw an impact from the pandemic. The one thing I'll point out is that 2019 to 2021 report, we were able to look at month by month. And so you can see the gradual improvement through the year. You know, if you're looking back in January of 2021, it was a 42% decline. So you're still talking about a huge impact in participation. October, the best month, was at 11.9% decline. So you're seeing a much better growth by then. November got hit a little bit harder. Things were really definitely getting better throughout the year. And I think that is, if you want to look at 2022, we expect to see some continued improvement like that.
Okay. So do you, I mean, it's a difficult question and it's quite early in 2022, but is 2022 looking like it's going to be even closer to a normal year, I guess?
Yeah, I don't have all of the numbers on the early part of the year specifically, but I know what we have looked at is there's definitely a little bit of an impact from Omicron. So January numbers don't look super great, but they do look better than January of 2021. And we expect, again, as that wave, you know, moves past, we think the spring will be much closer, especially because a lot of spring events in 2021 were moved to the fall. We don't expect to see that same wave of events shifting around dates quite as much. Hopefully.
Okay, that's great. That's great. So 2021 is sort of like halfway house between 2019 and a 2020, or like a normal year and a disaster year. So that's good. Things are pointing up. One of the things, as you say, this report, seeing as we are in the pandemic, is a little bit special, and it has data in it that, you know, you may not have found in previous reports. One of the numbers that I found there was some statistics around events that occurred in 2019, but have not been taking place since. So they didn't take place in 2020 or 2021. So what percentage is that? And like, what is it telling us in terms of the effect the pandemic has had the last couple of years on the industry?
Yeah, so that report, it's our churn report. And we actually looked this year only at the last 6 months of the year. Again, I won't go into, it's just logistics of why we picked those 6 months. we normally, again, would look at events in 2020, how many of them didn't happen again in 2021. This year, we thought it was important to go back a little bit. So a total of 18% of events in 2019 did not recur in 2021. Caveat to that, it only represents races that are 500 participants and larger. It's a manual report, so that does not include all event types. From that, we could also say 10.7% of those of events in 2019 didn't happen in 2020 or 2021. The other 7.3% that didn't happen in 2021 had taken place in 2020. That leaves a lot of open questions about whether those events are permanently canceled or whether they had 2 years off and are planning to come back. But we do, you know, expect that at least some percentage of those that haven't happened for the last 2 years will just decide that their race is over.
Do you feel that, actually, that's a good point, that of that 20% that sort of took a two-year sabbatical, is there still some hope that some of those events might be coming back?
I do think so. There's definitely events that, you know, did not feel like they were a good fit for virtual, chose to just kind of take the year off rather than going that route, and weren't ready to do an in-person event yet, and will decide now that they're back, they want to come back, they want to have an event again. It's going to be a little bit challenging to reach participants after 2 years away. But I do think there's events that will give it a shot and may, you know, may get people really excited to come back again.
And in terms of sort of the other side of things, green suits, do we have any sense of what percentage of that may have been filled by new events coming onto the market, new events taking place, taking older events place?
I definitely think there is some of that. It's a little bit harder to quantify. You know, we can say that we've seen less of an impact on our overall platform than on a per race basis, which means we are getting new events. It's hard to gauge at this point how much of that is new events in the market and how much of it is, mm-hmm. you know, events that are coming to us. There's definitely a percentage of events, and I know we'll talk a little bit later about virtual and how that works, but there's a percentage of unique event types and events that do not look like traditional events that have stepped in as well. And some of those may take the place of some older traditional events. I also think there definitely have been people in the market who, you know, have worked really hard, and, you know, good race management companies who've taken some of the opportunities to step in where there's gaps. And that may continue as well. I think especially this year, as events are more widely open, if it's clear that events aren't coming back, I do expect to see, you know, ambitious race directors step in and start growing their business.
Besides the outright cancellations, there was a comment in the report about postponements and the impact this has been having, particularly the erratic postponements, moving events, canceling events, then, you know, deciding, oh, there's a window of opportunity, let me put on my event on a different month. That sort of like has been having some impact on participant loyalty. What's been happening there?
Yeah, well, I can say what it was. Yeah, 10.6% of the events in 2019 that did happen again in 2021 moved to a new month. So there was a lot of shifting around. That's definitely going to change traditions. I think we talk about running as traditions a lot. And part of that, you know, it's borne out in how much people come back to an event year after year after year. One of the things that we look at is what we call repeat participation. So it's how many people who participated in the 10K in this race in 2019 came back in the 10K in this race in 2020. And that's definitely been impacted by the pandemic. I think before pre-pandemic years, we saw kind of steadily around 17 to 18% of participants came back year after year. And that means they came back to the exact same event. So how many came back to the race and maybe switched between the 5K and the 10K is probably a little bit higher than that. That was a pretty steady number. In 2020, there were only 10% who had returned from 2019. And in 2021, we just saw about 12% who returned from 2020. And some of that, maybe people are coming back, but they switched to virtual in 2020 and came back to in-person in 2021. Some of that is definitely going to be that, you know, whoever your 2019 runners were, weren't interested in your virtual option in 2020. And so you filled that in some with new runners who weren't your previous runners. But the sense of loyalty and it being kind of the same cohort of runners has definitely been impacted.
And I guess like with other numbers that we're going to be talking about, the expectation is that as we go through, basically, as we start converging to more normality in terms of, you know, what 2019 may have looked like, those numbers are expected to recover as well. Repeat participation?
We think so. I certainly hope so. But I think we saw a little bit of a movement back towards that this year. I think we will likely see more improvement in that in 2022. And that kind of goes across a lot of the numbers, there's a lot of places where we saw shifting that in the direction of 2019, and we weren't quite there, but it's looking more and more like pre-pandemic numbers, a little bit faster, I think, than I would have guessed.
Okay, great. So in terms of the statistics on individual event types, I was going through the data on the report, and it seems that most types of events have the same percentage of participation across the spectrum. So they're not gaining or losing too much. One of the data and by the way, I should explain for people who look at the report that ultras is a particular bucket you have there for ultra distances that includes all kinds of stuff and, you know, can be a little bit murky in terms of the conclusions you draw. But one bucket that should be pretty straightforward and shows a pretty massive growth between 2020 and 2021 is triathlons. So basically, you measure there that triathlons have grown in participation something like 170% between 2020 and 2021. Do we know if there's a particular reason behind that?
I think there's a couple of things. One is just that there are fewer triathlons than other event types, and therefore, you know, there's more volatility. If we have large events that were canceled in 2020 that came back in 2021, that's going to make a much larger impact on the data. If you go back, if I like and look at the report from a year ago, triathlons had the largest decline during the pandemic. And I think, again, some of that is just it's hard to know as well because it's a smaller sample size, how much of it is industry-wide. But it's also an event type that we saw be a little bit more hesitant and slower to come back because there's touch points on triathlons. It could just be a harder type of event to get approval for and to get moving again. So I do think there was a little bit of a slower return for them, which then made, you know, a better 2021 really show for them.
And I guess now that you mentioned that, maybe another factor may be that in 2020, when basically you had a big pickup on virtual races, triathlons are probably the least likely event to be able to put on a virtual, right? Where other events were switching to virtual, doing a virtual triathlon may not have been as straightforward an option for most people.
Yeah, we saw, I mean, there were a handful, but yeah, we saw far fewer virtual triathlons than you would see of like a, you know, a regular triathlon.
Well, speaking of virtual versus in-person races, I mean, you know, the whole virtual explosion of events almost feels like centuries ago now. But, you know, there was a time during the pandemic when almost every race that was normally going on switched to a virtual race. Is this trend sort of like declining? What does the data tell us generally for the future of the virtual race format as we sort of start to approach normality again?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is clear that people are super excited to come back in person. We saw all throughout the year, again, really until like the very end of the year when we got some Omicron impacts, a steady increase in the percentage of participants who were choosing to go in person. That being said, I don't think we're going to see a complete reversion back to 2019. Our pre-pandemic numbers, about 1% of our registrations were for virtual events. This year, we ended up, I think our overall numbers were 15.9% for regular virtual events, and then another 4.5% for virtual challenges. So, you know, more than 20% of participants were opting for virtual. That did decrease by the end of the year. I think in our most in-person month, we saw about 92% people in person. And I think that's probably more representative of what we'll see is there will be a some percentage, more than 1%, that wants to continue to do virtual and is looking for that kind of an option. But it will, you know, in person will be your dominant choice.
Beyond the data, which is very interesting, you guys also speak to race directors day in, day out. And, you know, you get all kinds of feedback and sort of like the sentiment of what's happening on the ground. I know from our group that there's a particular cohort of race directors and myself as a participant, I can't fault them too much, that are a little bit sick of virtual races. And, you know, they can't wait to go back to like traditional straight out in-person formats. Having had virtual races behind them, seen the benefits, seen like the incremental revenue and all that, are they convinced that, you know, the virtual option is something they need to have in the mix going forward?
I think a lot of them are. And I think it's going to look different for different events. We see that the people who choose to do virtual events are often different from the ones who choose to do in-person events. And you don't want to alienate a new group of runners, particularly ones who just started joining your events in the last couple of years. That being said, there's always going to be a you know, mathematical calculation of how much of your time it's worth to do an extra event versus the extra participants who will come as a virtual participant. And it is important if you're going to do a virtual event. I think people are no longer interested in just, you know, oh, I signed up for this and I got a medal and that's it. They do want some more features to their virtual event now. So I think we've seen it work in a couple of different ways with some of our events. They always have a built-in virtual option. They know it's going to be a little bit smaller than their in-person option, but they have the resources to put towards, you know, putting on a good virtual option for people. Other race directors we've seen take the tactic that they're not doing a virtual option for their regular events, but they'll do one really good virtual race during the year as a way to keep those people, you know, who want to do virtual engaged in something. So there's a couple, you know, there's different ways that you can approach it. I think not everyone will do virtual all of the time, but thinking about how you keep those participants who came to you as virtual participants happy can make sure that, you know, you maintain that for the future.
So speaking of those participants, what I could tell from the report, there's some nice data on the gender breakdown in terms of people who participate in in-person and virtual races. And there's a clear bias there for virtual events in favor of female participants. So generally, female participants are the majority of participants in all kinds of events, but that's exacerbated even further in virtual events. I think there's something like 70% of virtual participants, something like that, are female participants. Beyond that, do we know anything else about like the virtual runner? Because you said it's not the same person who would participate in an in-person event. How is the virtual runner profile different than the in-person runner profile?
Yeah, like you said, it's definitely more likely to be women. We also see it tends to be older runners. I think it was at 31, 32% of all virtual participants are over the age of 50, when it's like 23, 24% for in-person events, which tells us it's people who are looking for a little bit more flexibility. We see that it's often newer runners, people who have not come to your events before. You see less repeat participation there. It's people who are maybe not ready to go to a real event or don't want to work, you know, for whatever reason, work an off shift, have too much responsibility. They want to participate in something, but they don't have any interest in showing up. So you're looking at, you know, older, mostly female runners who may not be interested in an in-person event.
I mean, that's quite interesting because I wouldn't have thought, for some reason, when I think virtual, maybe because it's a novelty thing, I would have thought that it would appeal more to younger, non-traditional type runners, right? Not like the 65-year-old who overtakes me in marathons all the time. Like, you know, they're really quite fit, regular runner.
I think anecdotally, I think it's a lot of mothers and grandmothers who like being active. They go out to walk or run with their friends, but never thought of going to a race. They aren't competitive. They don't care to be competitive. It's just something that they do for fun, and they pick a virtual option as something to, you know, motivate them to be active, something that they can do kind of with their friends outside of traditional hours instead of being, you know, in a big race event.
Do you have any feeling whether a cause or a charity behind the virtual event is also like a big driver for people taking part? Because the race experience isn't there, right? I mean, so there must be other stuff behind it.
Yeah, I think the big drivers are either going to be really cool swag, having something really fun to give people, a really cool theme, or the charity that they're fundraising for. Charities, you know, done right can be a huge motivator either way. It does depend on the base behind that cause. But people, and actually that's one that we see reports, that, not from us, but generally have seen a lot of reports about how millennials and Gen Z are much more motivated to do things when there's a good cause behind it. And so that can be a good way to get people engaged is by saying, you know, this is not, you're not just out doing this walk. You're doing this walk for this reason, and really put the focus on the cause.
And what about virtual challenges? This is something that you guys have invested quite a lot of technology in supporting people who wanted to put on virtual challenges. Is it fair to, and actually in the report, there's places where you actually break out numbers for virtual races versus virtual challenges. Is there a significant difference in terms of the people who run virtual challenges to the people who run virtual races, or to the motivation, or to the format? Or like, to me, virtual challenges just seem like, you know, almost like multi-day longer types of virtual races. Or is there like a fundamental difference between the two?
There's not a huge difference, at least this year. There was actually more of a difference last year. Both end up being, you know, more female and more older runners. motivationally, there would seem to be a difference because a virtual challenge is going to be something that you're doing for several weeks or months. But I don't see a huge demographic difference between them. They're much more similar than in-person, and either virtual option is.
Do you see virtual challenges being, you know, continuing to have a meaningful presence going forward, like virtual races might?
We do. I mean, again, it's not going to be 20% of runners, but I think virtual challenges have a really compelling argument to stick around because they're different. They're something that, you know, we see a lot of events do as like a, you know, it's a training program to get ready for an event. It's motivation to stick to someone's goals. It's a fun way to kind of get yourself active. And so I think there's a little bit more incentive there that's built into a virtual challenge. I think you actually have to work a little bit harder with a virtual race to make your case for why someone would want to do your event. Whereas a virtual challenge, if you do it well, there's a lot of reward built into doing something for a long period of time.
The next part of the report, which is, I think, one of people's favorites, is participant demographics. That's the section where you actually break down participation in races by age groups and other in other kinds of dimensions. An interesting thing I find there is that, you know, we mentioned already that female participants are more than male participants, something like a 55-45 split there for in-person races, which then gets exaggerated even more in favor of female participants for virtual races. So the interesting thing I find there in conjunction with another part of the report further down on swag is that although female participants are the majority of participants, still only 3.1% of events offer a female-specific shirt option. And that's actually down from 2017. So that 3.1 used to be something like a 10% back in 2017, and it's trending downwards. I mean, that's a bit of a puzzle, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, that's probably a slight undercount because of people using their own terminology to put in giveaways, but it is pretty clear that most people are still choosing unisex shirt sizes. So when female shirt sizes were offered, almost 30% of people had chosen a small or an extra small size. Typically, those are going to be sizes that do not have a comparable size if you go with the unisex shirt option. So I think it's pretty noticeable that people are often providing swag, which is a great provider or great driver of registrations, that is not actually functionally usable for a large portion of their participants. And you know, I know a lot of that this year may have been driven by supply chain issues and financial questions with the pandemic and not wanting to overextend on too many options. But it really can be a great way to reach a large portion of excited participants to have swag that they are excited about and they feel like is made for them.
I was so surprised by that I sort of dug up some posts in the group about people wondering whether they need to offer female-specific shirt sizes. And it is indeed one of the points coming up, the inventory management side of things, of course, gets more complicated, right? When you have yet another, you know, type of shirt and you need to, you know, like split your inventory across more non-fungible kind of stuff because some people get male, some people get female and stuff. Although it might be a hassle, it feels to me like that more events need to be offering that option. There were lots of disgruntled people, and that's race directors in the group making those comments that either as a runner or from the perspective of a race director, it's just not good enough for people to be giving out unisex t-shirts for races anymore, right?
And it's a selling point for your event. And you can label them in different ways. If you don't want to say it's a female shirt and a male shirt, you can say it's a slim cut and a larger cut or whatever, however you want, relaxed fit, however you want to phrase it for your event. But the more you give options, use that as a selling point. Say, we have this really cool shirt that you're going to love and it's going to fit you. There's something for everyone here. And you know, people know they're actually walking away with something rather than just signing up with like, well, I'll probably have another t-shirt to throw away.
Yeah. I mean, that's the other thing, right? I mean, people generally, they have so many t-shirts that in the end, one of the reasons maybe why they don't complain enough is because, you know, people don't end up using many of those t-shirts anyway, but it's a shame. I mean, you know, you're going to be producing that. It's going to go to waste. Personal opinion here. I think people need to start thinking harder about offering, you know, options for female runners that they can actually use. Another statistics in the participant demographic stuff that is, of course, very persistent and very worrying, I think, for the industry long term, is the trend with younger runners, particularly millennials and Gen Zers. And Tell us a little bit about the numbers, actually. Just tell people who don't have the report in front of them what's happening in terms of the age group breakdown for participation.
Yeah, the biggest group that's a little bit concerning has been 18 to 29-year-old runners, which, you know, is obviously where you want people to start building their traditions with your event as young adults and really get into the racing scene. Pre-pandemic, we already saw that falling. I think it was around 18% in 2017 and gone down to about 16% in 2019. It's continued to go down. It dropped last year and then actually dropped further this year to just shy of 13% of total runners. It's concerning because those are future runners as well. We saw a little bit of a drop as well with 30 to 39-year-olds and even into the 40s. But our biggest change was with that 18 to 29-year-old group.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, you know, the 18 to 29 was always a bucket that didn't look very good for the industry. But it's very worrying to even see those trends now creep into the 30 to 39-year-olds, right? I mean, that's not your 18-year-old runner, right? I mean, that used to be almost, right, you know, like the age group where most people were coming into running, and that's declining now.
Yeah, that actually did fall even from last year. We hope that some of that is just the uncertainty of this year and some of those people are going to be more inclined to come back. I think one thing that is a little bit concerning about it is typically throughout COVID, the people who've had the least, you know, reason and need to be as concerned about health and you have that as a reason not to go to events are younger people. And so if they were still showing up at a lower, slower rate, that's a little bit of a problem.
And actually, maybe because you also break down in the report age group statistics between in-person and virtual races. And as we were mentioning earlier, younger runners make an even poorer showing in virtual races. That may point to one of the reasons why the industry fails to attract more younger people, right? Which is the race experience, of which you have very little in a virtual race and even less of a reason for younger participants to go into a virtual race.
Yeah, I think, you know, when we talk about events for younger runners, it really needs to be something that is fun and exciting. Competition is a little bit less important. The races that we think do really well with that are events that do things like have good team programs where people can join and come together, have a fun contest with that, make it something that people can do together. I know it's been really hard over the last year to have much of a post-race experience, but as that's able to happen again, those kinds of things can be a good attraction for runners, for younger runners, as well as we mentioned before, keeping a focus on what the cause is for the event and where their money is going beyond just like a thing that they're doing. They're going to be a lot more interested in doing events that way.
Yeah, I mean, I used to think that when you had all those novel formats of, you know, like the color run and the bubble run and the this run and the other, you know, like chocolate run and night run and whatever. I was actually speaking to someone the other day and he was telling me night runs are a very, very strong thing with younger runners. Does the industry have to like completely reinvent race formats all the time to get people out just to try the one thing once and then move to something else?
Yeah, I think that's a challenge. Like you said, I think those types of events are really good at getting people to come out occasionally. Turning those into regular race participants we have failed to do as an industry. So I think part of it is just getting people out once, but then also once they're there, finding lower key ways to make things fun and exciting, spectator engagement, making sure that there's a lot of people along the course, that kind of experiential thing can help, you know, convince people that a regular 5K can also be fun. But you do have to get them there once to start with. So,
yeah, I mean, that's every episode we do on trends and stuff, this thing comes up. It doesn't look like, you know, it's going to be fixing itself anytime soon. I really don't know what the answer to this might be, but it's definitely something that, you know, individual race directors and other bodies in the industry need to start thinking about. Being in an aging industry is not particularly optimistic.
Yeah. It's one of the, on an individual race basis, this is not going to fix it for the industry, but it's, you know, doing things like working with your high school cross country club and getting them out to regular races. So it's something that they've seen before when they get into their 20s, or working with college clubs to try to get them to come out and do things and trying to reach people when they're young and expose them to events so that it's something that they're familiar with and ready for when they can actually pay for them.
Moving on to event statistics. I think many people will be surprised to hear I think that's an awesome statistic, that 96% of in-person events, at least for 2021, had fewer than 500 participants. So basically, if your event had 500 participants in 2021, you were on the top fourth percentile of races.
Yeah, and that's not unusual. That is similar to what we saw pre-pandemic years. And I think we like to include that because a lot of the times the press and the news and what gets talked about in the industry is going to be your Boston marathons and your New York marathons and your huge events that attract, 20, 30, 40,000 people. But that's not the experience of most events. So, look for resources that are going to be a lot more appropriate for your type of event. You don't need the same things that an event like that does. You want to find race directors who are like you, who put on small local events and pull resources from there.
Yeah, but actually, I think many people, many race directors and many vendors in the industry don't realize how fragmented the industry is. I have people tell me we're discussing something and we want to pick like a theoretical race to work on. And we'll say, yeah, let's say it's a small 1,000 person race, right? And a 1,000 person race, it's really by statistical standards in terms of the industry, a very large race.
I think events are much smaller than people realize.
That's true. So in terms of the registration trends and when participants register, that used to be a very big debating point during the pandemic. Lots of people reporting that, I see participants registering later and later for my event. And actually, in this year's edition of the Race Trends Report, there's some really, really great and clear data on that in terms of when they registered during 2021 and what that equivalent pattern has been for 2019. So what does the data tell us on that?
So I think the super procrastination theory does not hold true. We had about 25% of participants register on race week, which is very consistent across the years. I think we've been between 24 and 26% every year since 2017. Where we did see a little bit of a shift is really that, 60 to 15 days before the event, an increase in runners kind of 1 to 2 months outside or out before the event. We did not see as many participants signing up, 3 and 4 months out. And I think that's probably a combination of two things. One being that, events were much later to open registration. They were slower to commit while they were kind of watching what was going on with the world. Not wanting to have to cancel and that kind of thing. And then participants also watching what the status was, wanting to make sure they felt a little bit more comfortable that the event would move forward. So it didn't seem to push people all the way to the end to make a decision, but we did see a little bit of a shift later than normal.
Okay. So basically you're saying that the really, really deferred, the really, really early registrations essentially moved a little bit closer. So sort of like the people who used to register 3 to 4 months out, maybe they moved to 1 or 2 months out. And part of that, as you said, may be a little bit artificially inflated by the fact that registration windows weren't the same in 2021. So they may have been a little bit shorter. But essentially what people have been reporting of, noticeable changes in terms of, race week registrations and stuff just doesn't hold true in terms of historical data.
As an overall aggregate, no. I mean, there's obviously going to be specifics to any area and any individual race. So I cannot tell a race director that they did not see that personally. But as an overall aggregate, it's been pretty normal.
And there's some interesting also data there on price increases. So it's a very interesting fact that you guys measure, because you have the data on it, how many price increases events choose to deploy over the registration life cycle. Can you tell us a little bit about the statistics of basically how many price increases do events choose to have during the registration life cycle and how that affects registrations?
Yeah. So I think it's actually fewer price increases than I would have guessed, because I normally see events with price increases. For shorter distances, we've typically seen 1 to 1.5, on average. Obviously no event is really doing a half of the price increase per race, where it's been closer to 2 price increases for longer distances. Normally they have longer registration periods. So that's part of that. That did drop way back in 2020. I think everyone in 2020 was hesitant to do things like price increases and kept things a little bit simpler. We saw some shift back this year, although we're still seeing more like 1 to 1.5 price increases across most distances rather than up to the 2 to 2.5. One of the impacts of that is we measure how many registrations come in within 3 days of a price increase or registration closing, which is to say, how many of your registrations are coming in during this very narrow window, but right around a big call to action. And in 2021, we were at about 20% of participants registered within that window. Prior to the pandemic, we were about 27% pretty consistently there. So that difference is probably that there have been fewer price increases. So there's just fewer people within those windows. But I do tend to think, from what we can see, price increases are a really good motivator to get people who maybe have been looking at your event but are on the fence to actually follow through and make the purchase and commit to the event. So using that kind of thing, as event schedules stabilize, getting them back into your calendar so that people have some incentive and you have a reason to email them and say it's time to register.
Yeah, I actually thought that was a very interesting statistic. The fact that, you have on average 2 price increases per registration cycle. And you're saying that between around 1/4 of participants register within 3 days of each of those price increases. So basically within 6 days, let's say on average, if you have 2 price increases, you get 25% or 27% before the pandemic of your total registration count, which sounds crazy. I mean, it's a huge proportion of your total registrations. And the question then, I guess, is would having more price increases help even more, I guess?
There's obviously a limit. And I think, again, it depends on how long your race is open. We do see a large marathon that's open for 6 months will have 6 different price increases because they have such a large window to open it out with. If your race is only open for 2 months, that's going to be overkill and no one's going to care. But I do think, using that to kind of find where the sweet spots are, where people are looking for registrations and figuring out how, if it's worth adding an extra one for a little extra incentive. The other thing that we see people doing is, people were worried about the race week, race day registrations. You're never going to stop all of them, but you can kind of price those at a premium to encourage people to really get in a little bit earlier. And then also, for those who don't, get yourself a little bit of extra income.
I guess it's very difficult to say whether similar events, one with price increases and one without, how they would sort of perform relatively in terms of registrations.
Yeah, I don't think there's a functional way for us to pull that.
Okay, because it sounds like people, that statistic around how many people register around 3 days of its price increase, it sounds like there's people there who want to register and somehow the price increase makes them wait for that moment and just register at the last minute. And it's just, you need to wonder what would those people have done if there weren't any price increases? I guess they would just register, right? Would they?
Hopefully. Some of them probably would. And some of them may actually just have kept saying, well, I'll look at it later, and then not had a motivation to do it. So it's a good way to make sure people don't wait so long that they just don't register.
Yeah. Okay, great. Another very interesting area of the report, always, I know race directors look at that quite closely, is pricing trends. So what's been happening with average entry fee prices across the different events and across the last couple of years?
Yeah. So, we had seen a kind of very gradual increase in prices year to year over the pandemic, before the pandemic, which I think is to be expected. Prices crashed, dropped significantly in 2020. One thing that's hard is we can't actually split out virtual and in-person for pricing. So what a lot of that pricing is driven by is that virtual events tend to have low overhead. If you have a longer distance event, a marathon in person is going to cost a lot more than a 5K in person because you have a lot more overhead there. For a virtual, they're about the same. So longer distances really saw prices fall as you built in a lot more virtuals. In 2021, prices did go back up pretty significantly. We're not quite where we were in 2019, again, particularly on the longer events, I think, again, driven by virtual. But we saw a lot more movement towards normal, which I think does tend to tell us, you know, if we took those virtuals out, that prices are either back to normal or up a little bit. 5Ks, I think, are only down from 2019 by like 3 or 4%. And that's including a number of virtual events. So I would expect that real price is a little bit higher than what you see on the paper.
Because, I mean, obviously, as you say, the ebbing and flowing of virtual events has been the determining factor for most event types in terms of average prices. But of course, it's clear to everyone that we're operating, and you know, lots of people have commented on this, in an inflationary environment, and costs have definitely gone up. You would guess that what's happening with in-person races is that in-person fees should be going up.
Yeah, we can't state that definitively because we can't see it split that way. But based on how they've increased compared to last year, while seeing fewer virtual but still a good number of virtual, I think it's likely that actual prices for in-person events have gone up some.
I wonder actually whether triathlon here as well might shed some light on this, because you know, triathlons, as we mentioned, didn't have that many virtual events because of the format. It's a little bit difficult, and you know, for some people to have put virtual events around that. And actually, triathlons are up. Average price is 7.3% in 2021 compared to 2019. It's the only event type that actually strictly up over 2019, right?
Yeah. Yes. Sorry. Also a 1 miler, but I think that would be too small of a sample to really matter. Yeah. And I think that's a good point, that triathlons are probably the least impacted by virtual. And you can tell because their price in 2020 was also the closest to 2019. So they've been pretty steady from 2017 to 2020, and that did go up a significant amount this year.
So the rest of the report, there's some great stuff into fundraising and other stuff that unfortunately we probably don't have the time to delve into in super great detail. But there's some very interesting trends in terms of the technologies that people use to register and the channels that they use to discover races and register for them. And one of them is around the trends in mobile adoption. So, you know, how many people come through and register or visit your race through a desktop device versus a mobile device. And I know that's not, you know, like in the forefront of everyone's minds, you know, like worrying about these kinds of trends, but they are significant and they have been building over time. So what are those trends for mobile adoption, and what kind of conclusions should or recommendations should people be taking away in terms of, you know, their future approach to marketing their events?
Yeah, I mean, we've been focusing on this for several years now. The rate at which people are using phones for looking at and registering for events continues to go up. This is actually the first time we've seen it stay sort of steady, specifically on people who are looking at races on their phone. So it's we can measure how many people are looking at your race websites from a phone, and that's at like 70% of all views, which means most people are seeing your race website from a mobile phone. The percentage that actually complete the registration on a mobile phone is smaller than page views, but we've got that again has continued to increase. Back in 2017, like 33% of participants were registering on phones, and that's now up to about 57%. What that says is it's really important that you are thinking not just, you know, is your website mobile friendly, but literally it's more important that it's mobile friendly than it is it's computer friendly. Like everyone still does things on a laptop and then takes it to a phone. So making sure you're always testing that your website is mobile friendly, and then even taking that over into things like registration, not asking more questions than you need. Obviously, there's value to having data, but if you have a registration that is 5 pages long, that's really frustrating for people on a phone. Making sure that you're always thinking about the experience on a phone so that, you know, you're not losing people in that process.
Yeah, and I think for run sign up customers in particular, that's important because you guys offer so many different choices of options that people can use to basically, you know, structure their registration flow. And I sense sometimes, having looked at a few run sign up registration pages, that some people really need to think a little bit harder. And I guess that you know extends to other platforms as well, but they need to think harder when they have all those many options and all that data they can collect. I think they need to balance the benefits of collecting that additional data to maybe losing some people during checkout, you know, like, you know, when someone has to tick 50 boxes just to get to the checkout page.
Yeah, it's, you know, obviously we can't say what any individual race needs to know, but be intentional about what you're asking. And if you don't need information, don't ask.
And I guess the transition to mobile is also important for younger audiences, right? I mean, I guess more younger audiences use mobile over desktop. I mean, lots of the business that most 18-year-olds do is exclusively over a mobile phone. So paying attention to that is probably also important to that aspect of registrations.
Yeah, I would say that. And I would say the second thing is that the concern we always hear when people talk about people registering on their phones, we do a lot of you know, recommending races let people register on their phones, even on race morning. And a lot of pushback is that older runners won't know how to do that. And the fact that these percentages keep increasing tells us that older runners are learning too, because 58% of our runners aren't, or 57% aren't under, you know, 30, but they are also registering on their phones. So someone else is learning too.
One of the comments actually I had from someone who was into event marketing is that the fact that people can more easily register on phones has also given rise to things like Instagram marketing for races. So basically, you know, I think it might have been Thomas Neuberger actually making this comment in an earlier podcast, that the fact that Instagram is becoming more and more relevant in terms of traffic acquisition for races is very much supported by the fact that the technology on mobile registrations is getting better and better. So they can get people from Instagram onto the registration page directly. And speaking of Instagram, actually, and Facebook and all of those social media sites, what's the picture in terms of acquisition and where people are discovering races from, in terms of the social media at least?
Yeah, we look at that in a couple of different ways, but I think I'll just focus on, we pull data from Race Insights, which is our own tracking system that, you know, can say how many registrations were referred by a specific other website. In 2020, that was really high. We saw about 12% of registrations directly from Facebook. And in 2021, that halved down to about 6%. That being said, I don't think that's cause to say social media is done. We don't need to use social media anymore. There's a couple of different factors that go into that. One is that the pandemic just drastically increased the amount of time that people were spending on their phones and on social media. We saw huge spikes in social media impacts across the board last year. And that 6% that we saw registrations this year is actually higher than the number of social, the number of registrations from social media in 2019, when we were at about 4.6. So it's still a big driver. We also, you know, there is likely some impact from some of the changes Facebook has made to advertising over the last year. We have, you know, heard from some of our larger clients who do a lot of social media advertising that that's had an impact on how well they're able to drive registrations from Facebook. So some of it could be that as well. Although I think most events, the amount of time and attention that they put into Facebook advertising, it wouldn't have had that huge of an impact. It's a smaller part of their play anyways. More of what I think we see from Facebook is organic growth via Facebook. It's people who are registering for your event, and either because you have a good referral program or just because they're excited, they're sharing that they registered on Facebook and people are registering for that. I think that probably accounts for more of our social media registrations than actual advertising does.
Yeah, I guess whether the drop in Facebook traffic conversion from 2020 to 2021 from 12% to 6%, which is a very significant drop, given that the traffic itself from Facebook seems to have held during that period, may have something to do with all of that iPhone kind of, like, you know, iOS restrictions that Apple put through, and people could choose whether you want to be tracked or not. And now if you go into doing Facebook ads, you see all these messages that maybe for iPhone users using iPhone, I think like iOS 14 onwards, it's much more difficult to track conversions. And maybe that's part of the impact there.
Yeah, I mean, we can't see that specifically, but anecdotally, we've definitely heard that from some of the events that heavily use Facebook.
And of course, one other very, very interesting statistic on the side of participant acquisition is the fact that 8% of registrations, according to data, come from peer-to-peer referrals. Do we have any sense whether that's down to the specific tools that run sign-up offers being particularly strong in that area, or whether it's like a general trend? And how do people use peer-to-peer referrals effectively to grow their registrations?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's one that is probably impacted by the platform to some degree. We have a really good referral tool that makes it really easy for participants to get their, you know, referral code, to share it, and for a race to automatically offer a refund that they don't have to do manually. So it's a tool that's going to be used a lot more on our platform because it's kind of automated. That being said, there's a huge range in how people use it. And then with that, its effectiveness, the kind of main things that we focus on are, one, putting in a program that makes sense. So if you have, you know, if you're giving someone a dollar off for referring someone, that's not a really big motivator to refer them, and they're probably not really going to do it. You're going to end up giving $1 back several times, but no one's going to be super motivated to continue to bring people in. Where we tend to see the sweet spot is something like 3 to 5 referrals for, you know, a $15 to $25 refund. So it's enough money for people to think, I'm going to go out and I'm going to share. I might as well see if this works. But it's also a high enough threshold that most of those people may refer one or two people, but they're not actually going to get to the threshold to get a refund. And if they do, they've brought you enough people for it to be worthwhile for you financially anyways. On top of that, really, really successful programs will add a second or third layer where maybe if you refer 10 or 15 people, you get a really premium jacket. And it's an expensive item, something they can only get that way. You'll only have a handful of people who will ever achieve that. But those people are going to be bringing you a large population of people and really helping to grow your event.
Right. So just to break this down for people just a little bit, what we're saying here is that there are tools where basically you allow participants to refer other people. They use some kind of unique code that they send to their friends and family. And when they register, they get either a kickback or like a nice piece of swag or something like that. And that keeps them, you know, sufficiently motivated to then contribute an extra 8% on total registrations just from that channel.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think the last thing I'd say on it is, you know, it's really important with anything, if you want people to promote your event for you, that you communicate with them why and how. And so in every email that you send and on your website, highlighting the things that they're going to get when they refer people, because you really have to make that message clear and loud if you want people to then actually go out and kind of promote your event for you.
So lastly, seeing all this very rich, very deep data from 2021, how is what you're seeing, if at all, informing or updating or changing your plan at Run Sign Up going forward? What kinds of things are you going to be focusing on for 2022?
I think we're focused on tools to make things easier and cheaper for race directors. We've been doing a lot of development on websites and free email and ways that our race directors can, you know, have technology that doesn't cost them anything, so they can focus that money on, you know, recouping participants from 2020 or from 2019. Definitely focused on race day and on tools to help make races more efficient and more fun, so that as you're able to get participants back, they're excited, they have a good experience, and they want to come back. We work a lot with timers on getting their tools getting them up to speed on tools, so they can really provide a better experience for runners. And I think that's going to kind of continue to be where our focus is in 2022, is on technology, both on the pre-race and race day side.
I saw quite a few things on your email marketing revamp. People seem to be, Bob included, very excited about that. You're saying there's going to be one for race websites as well?
Yeah. So email, I will say, people have been asking us, complaining about our templates as long as I have worked at Run Sign Up. We have new templates and we are very excited about that. For websites, it's already actually on our ticketing platform that will get moved over to registration this year. We have a new website builder that's just going to be a little bit more intuitive. It's a little easier to move things around, build different blocks, kind of customize your website to look the way that you want.
Great. 2022 is looking brighter for everyone, I guess. Just a little bit brighter, right?
Yeah, we're excited. I think it's going to be a good year for events. You know, keep moving back up.
Awesome. Well, Johanna, it's been a pleasure again. I'm very, very grateful that you came here first to share some of this data with our listeners. We should say again that people can download the report from the Run Sign Up website at runsignup.com/trends. That's runsignup.com/trends. You can also find there, of course, all kinds of information on Run Sign Up, the platform itself, and all the kinds of stuff you can achieve with the tools on Run Sign Up. Hopefully, we're going to have an update on this probably like mid-year. We did that last year. It was quite effective doing like mini race trends reports. And I want to wish you guys, Run Sign Up, and of course, the rest of the industry a super great uptick in 2022. Thanks again for coming on, Johanna.
Thanks, Panos.
Thanks to everyone listening in, and we'll see you all on our next episode. I hope you enjoyed this episode on Race Trends with my guest, Give Sign Up, Run Sign Up's Johanna Good. You can find more resources on anything and everything related to race directing on our website, racedirectorshq.com. You can also share your questions about the numbers in today's podcast, registration trends, or anything else in our Facebook group, Race Directors Hub. If you enjoyed this episode, please don't forget to subscribe or leave us a review on your favorite player. And also check out the podcast back catalog for more great content like this. Until our next episode, take care and keep putting on amazing races.